CBS Eye on the World, the New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. I'm John Batchelor. To Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, the large and powerful state in the Americas that must be successful for the New World to remain successful. Reuters, Brazil's far-right former president Bolsonaro returned from the United States. Welcome back after 3 months by hundreds of chanting supporters at capital Brasilia's airport. Bolsonaro, writes Reuters, who never conceded defeat in last year's election, is expected to lead the opposition to leftist president Luiz Lula da Silva, according to officials in the party. Professor, Bolsonaro is operatic. Lula da Silva is relentless. We have here two towering figures in Brazilian politics. I don't have my history on Brazil, but this strikes me as a recognizable American scenario. William Jennings Bryan versus, and then fill in the blank, any time in the three presidential elections he conducted. A major figure. Nobody has to ask who he is. Nobody has to ask what's he for. It comes with the grin of the man. I remember him vividly in the last campaign starting a rally on motorcycles. I think he was in black leather in Sao Paulo leading a cavalcade of Harleys, which I loved him for, of course, because I live in a place where on the weekends the very expensive Harley-Davidsons show up in long cavalcades, very successful professional men riding their Harleys. So I identified with him, but he is also represents trouble for Lula da Silva and for order in Brazil. Is this good news that he's back? Remember, we had those weeks of talk of extradition and charges because of the disruption in Brasilia. So is his return now beginning to a debate and not violence?
Well, John, I think this probably will go out with a whimper and not a bang, although there could be some troubling actions coming with respect to what the Brazilian justice system ultimately chooses to do if they find a reason to take charges forth against Bolsonaro that will unleash a new political firestorm. But in general, this is unprecedented, what is happening in Brazil in general, and again, it shows some of the socioeconomic stresses and the impact on politics that we've talked about elsewhere. So Brazil historically has been a multicultural, very tolerant country. That's kind of wedded into Brazil is talking not only their domestic but their foreign policy. And so for Brazil under Bolsonaro and before to have gotten to the level of polarization where those kind of core supporters of Bolsonaro, not unlike some of the core supporters of former President Trump, and especially those coming from a more rural agricultural background, those who see themselves as kind of left behind by political correctness, left behind by the new politics. See really Bolsonaro is somebody who is rallying to protect their rights, and so his return suggests that again he's decided to take the risks and continue to play a role, and that will certainly rally his base. I think we will continue to see some. The degree to which he remains salient in Brazilian politics, there are important differences between the way Brazilian and U.S. politics works. Certainly within the Brazilian Senate, as Lula goes forward and is the Congress in general, you have really within the Chamber of Deputies, you have about really a little over 100 people who would be considered affiliated with his Liberal Party and other related parties. You have about a similar number, a little bit less, that would be affiliated with the PT and Lula. And then you have a bunch of really kind of transactional parties in the middle that they call the Central. So the challenge for Lula, Lula, who just announced, was forced to postpone his visit to the PRC. Because of a case of pneumonia, apparently. Illustrates that, again, that Lula, with his age and not in the best of health, it'll be interesting to see whether he has the vitality to really deal with this in an effective way. But I think what it illustrates is that you will continue to have this polarization of politics and polemic as Bolsonaro's presence continues to create events that allow his supporters to rally around. Not unlike we saw in the United States in Washington with the talk of President Trump being indicted and arrested over the Stormy Daniels affair, and that created certain political flashbang in Washington. So I think this is going to continue to drag out, although I don't think it will have quite the effect on Brazilian politics as we've seen. It's a correspondent effect with President Trump having in Washington.
It is 4 years till the next election, but just in case we needed more melodrama, there's a story, and I need your help, that Lula da Silva is in some fashion connected to or not opposed to or associated with a punishment or harassment or abuse, or even in one case, one version, an assassination attempt on a man who is now Senator Moro, I believe is his name, who previously was the judge who was said to be most responsible for the jailing of Lula da Silva on the car wash scandal. Now, that's a lot of gossip. However, it is in the air. Is that significant for Lula da Silva's authority that suddenly he's back to defending himself or in some fashion explaining his jailing for his bad acting in the early part of this century?
John, I really think this is a testimony of the level of political division that you have. And in Brazil and other parts of Latin America, kind of speculation about dark forces, oftentimes connected with US CIA or other actors being kind of behind political developments are often made. Without knowing exactly what's going on, I mean, certainly it's not impossible. But Sergio Moura, who was essentially the prosecutor who went after Lula for the car wash scandal and his ties to that, among others, there was recently an attempt, or at least somewhat of an attempt against his life that was tied with one of the major Brazilian gangs, the PCC. And so some of us speculated that there may be darker forces at work in trying to take down Sergio Moura, who briefly became a presidential candidate as well. I suspect that that story may fade unless something unexpectedly substantial comes out about it. But again, it really imputes that some people see in the return of the PT, and you talk about the Sao Paulo Forum, which is kind of the coordinating forum started by the PT two decades ago for the Latin American left. Some people see essentially dark forces moving that lead them to advocate for extra systemic solutions. And I think it's that kind of loss of faith in the political system that is most putting Brazil at risk. And frankly, Lula, since he got back, some of the actions that he's taken in terms of reforms within the army and elsewhere, his and some of his greater radicalism in terms of aggressively taking his social policies forward and some of his foreign policies forward, it probably has not helped that attempt to depolarize and kind of take some of the hot air out of Brazilian politics these days.
Colombia, President Petro is said to be sympathetic with many of the center-left leaders throughout Latin America. Recently, President Petro has run into what I think is obstacles in his intention to follow the pattern established by a predecessor of negotiating and then forgiving the narco-terrorism gangs in exchange for surrendering of their weapons and coming into the political process. But it's gone awry, Professor. We talked about this last week, the frustration that Gustavo Petro is expressing in his negotiations. And now there's been violence, not only violence from a narco-terrorism gang, but a well-known one, an infamous one, ELN. Is Petro now derailed in his intentions? Is he going to become a different kind of president now that they're shooting back?
I suspect, John, that Petro will probably double down on what has been his style of coming up with grandiose sounding proposals and then having to back down from some of them and trying to implement others in chaotic fashion. One can recall, and Colombians recall well, back when he was mayor of Bogota, he came up with an idea that he presented in well-sounding form, that he was going to create a new governmental trash service and eliminate the old abusive private trash system, and it was done so badly that literally trash was piling up in the streets in Bogota for weeks before they had to find a solution. And so in many ways, I think we see with the current peace process is a reflection of that Petru style, the ability to come up with grandiose, good sounding things, but sometimes the implementation being a bit lacking. So in the present case, this goes back to what he calls total peace. And so his idea, again, as a former M19 guerrilla, was, let's at least go a little bit farther to show our goodwill and basically stop going after everyone and then try to work out a peace deal. So the first group that he sought a ceasefire with were the second of the major guerrilla groups, the National Liberation Army, or the ELN. But he also extended his desire to stop going after the leaders and have a ceasefire. This was around last Christmas, to other groups, including the biggest, essentially franchised narco group, the Gulf Clan, otherwise known as the Urabeños or the AGC, as well as dissidents from the FARC and various others. The problem was that when you just say, okay, we're going to stop going after the leaders and stop extraditing the leaders of criminal groups, they continue their criminality. And in the case of the ELN, the ELN also is a very decentralized organization. For example, Pablito of the Northeastern War Front, which is very active in illegal mining in the interior of Venezuela, as well as in the flatlands of Colombia, has very little interest in giving up his very, very lucrative activities. And so what's happening in all of those cases as they begin to unravel. And so in the case of the Gulf Clan, after the government stopped officially going after them, they essentially continued their extortion. They continued their other criminal activities. There was a series of killings and violence in Antioquia that ended up resulting in the death of about 18 people. And that basically forced the Petro government to say, okay, we're going to reactivate going after the Gulf Clan. We're going to, ceasefire is now off the table. You guys actually didn't stop your criminal activity. What a surprise. And so something similar has happened with the ELN, where because of the decentralized nature of the ELN, apparently in one of the most violent, complicated parts of Colombia, Norte de Santander, specifically a little place called Catatumbo, you had the ambush and killing of nine Colombian soldiers, again, apparently by the ELN. And so that basically forced Petro to say, wait, what's going on here? We got the ceasefire, but they're continuing to ambush and kill, Colombian soldiers. And so that has forced a reevaluation of whether the conditions of the ceasefire need to be broken and what the government should do now. So I think the common line across the total peace implementation is that there are some inherent difficulties that were never fully worked out before the government said, okay, we're going to, approach things with hugs and ceasefires and see what happens. So I think we're starting to see kind of the working through the consequences of those Petro policies. I don't think we'll see an abandonment of the Petro policies, but I think we'll see some adjustments in maneuvering with not only total peace, but a number of his other initiatives in the coming months.
Yes, plan is an important. Planning is. And the first time you meet the adversary, you tear it up and start again. That's Ike Eisenhower, and that would be Gustavo Petro. Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, The New World Report, Paraguay, next. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.